Welcome to Unapologetic Live. I am your host, Amala Epinobi. We are trying to do this segment called Devil's Advocate, which is why I got my little devil horns on and my little devil tail, because I'm going to be playing my old school leftist role, me 4 years ago, and interviewing somebody on sort of the anti-woke, maybe some might call conservative end of the spectrum. On today's episode, we're going to be focusing on the particular issue of gender theory, transgenderism, and the idea of whether or not we should be teaching this to children in school. Now, the person that I decided to bring on to talk about this is somebody who I follow on all platforms, but who is super prevalent on Twitter. His name is Colin Wright. He's an evolutionary biologist. He runs the publication Reality's Last Stand, and he's a contributing editor at Quillette. Colin Wright, thank you so much for being on the show today.
I'm so excited to be here. Thank you.
Awesome. So before I step into my role as a leftist and start grilling you on these issues, can you give people a little bit of your story and your background and how you got to talking about this stuff?
Yeah, sure. So as you mentioned, I'm an evolutionary biologist, or maybe I was one. I'm no longer in academia. So I graduated from UC Santa Barbara with my PhD in evolutionary biology in 2018. And then I became a postdoc research fellow at Penn State. And I was there from 2018 to 2020. And it was sort of during those times, maybe a little bit before, where I started noticing how the conversation around what sex is, what males and females are, and gender sort of were getting all muddled. And people were saying things like sex is a spectrum or a social construct. We should let people identify how they want to in and out of these biological categories. And I was always, you know, I'm pretty well grounded in biology, and I saw people that were making these claims that just were very wrong. They just weren't correct. And so I started writing about this stuff, and I didn't realize how much of a hornet's nest was out there that I was actually whacking at. And then people started just jumping on me, calling me a transphobe. And then I kind of got into it more by saying, you know, it's not just that they're wrong. This is actually a very harmful belief to think that sex is a social construct and things. And so I just sort of leaned in to this because I didn't feel like I could really focus on my own research when I knew half my students were unclear about what males and females were. And so I've really been kind of focusing on this for the last 4 years, really, reading about gender ideology, the harms of it, talking about sex, just trying to keep the rails from flying off the society of getting completely muddled in what's real and what's not.
And was there a moment that you had where you're like, oh, wow, people are really listening to what I have to say around this, and now I am sort of this arbiter that people are looking to for answers on this stuff? Was there a particular moment that happened for you, or did you just sort of stumble into this?
So I initially stumbled into it. The first article I wrote was for Quillette. It was called The New Evolution Deniers. And it was my comparison of sort of these woke people who are denying the reality of sex to sort of the young earth creationists back in the, you know, the 2010s, maybe between 2000 and 2010, who were, you know, denying that evolution is a real thing. I used to be in that community arguing against, you know, intelligent design and creationism. And I was seeing these parallel sort of arguments being made about sex denialism. So I kind of did this comparison of how, like, these are the new, like, biology, reality, evolution deniers. Because by denying males and females exist, I mean, this is how we reproduce. This is how, it's a fundamental aspect of our biology regarding the evolution of our species and mammals generally, and even some plants and mm-hmm. reptiles. So I wrote that article. It went pretty viral in Quillette. And then I had another series of articles, some in Quillette, like no one's born in the wrong body. And then I had an article called The Dangerous Denial of Sex that came out in the Wall Street Journal. And that's when things really just sort of blew up. And I just sort of leaned into it because people kept coming to me for clarity on what sex is, what males and females are. And I just thought it was really important. So I just sort of slid into this new lane of being a public educator, scientist on these matters.
Well, that's fantastic. And I must say, I've been a follower of you for quite some time. So I love all the content that you put out. You might not love me after I start this segment, because again, I'm going to step into a role of criticism. Guys, this is Devil's Advocate. Let's roll it. Okay. So, Colin, let's start off with establishing some common ground here. Now that I'm on the left on this, we both agree that gender dysphoria exists. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. So we've both established that there are people who sort of have this idea, and there is a certain, maybe we might call it an affliction, I personally wouldn't, where they think that they've been born in the wrong body and that their gender does not match the sex assigned at birth. Do you think that adults should be able to do whatever they want with their bodies if they choose to medically transition? Is there a certain point where that becomes okay for you?
Yeah, I have no problem generally with people who choose to transition once they're adults, because gender dysphoria, it creates this severe anxiety, discomfort in one's body. A lot of people, you know, the Buck Angels of the world, they say, you know, transitioning saved their lives. They really felt like they were born in the wrong body, and transitioning really helped ameliorate all that discomfort that they have. So, you know, just as I would let an adult female, if she wants to get breast implants, hey, even if a guy wants breast implants, like, if you're an adult, you go for it. If that's what makes you happy, you know, really all my criticisms about transitioning and stuff and the harms of gender ideology, you know, I think it can harm adults maybe who might make a mistake, but, you know, they're adults, they can do mm-hmm. what they want. My main focus is on whether or not we should be having children transition and basically sterilize themselves from the moments they're beginning mm-hmm. puberty onwards. If there's actually enough informed consent for these kids to be able to know the ramifications of what they're actually signing up for.
Okay, and fair enough, because I think at the end of this, we will get to the debate on children. I think we're going to find that we disagree on those things. Here's another point where I think people on your end of the spectrum tend to disagree. Would you use somebody's preferred pronouns if asked to do so?
It depends. I will use people's cross-sex pronouns, like my friend Buck Angel is a trans man, and I refer to Buck as he, him, if I'm talking to Blair White, which I'll be doing next week. In Texas, I'll have no problem referring to Blair White as she. I won't use like the gender neutral or the neo pronouns like Z, Zim, and he, her, Z, Zer, and all these, you know, Fae, Fair, these weird ones. I just think they're completely ideological. So, and it also depends too on the context. So if I'm just hanging out with Buck Angel or a trans person in a social setting, I have no problem using their preferred pronouns. If I'm in like a court of law where this really matters and we're trying to talk about whether or not males should have access to female spaces or certain things, then I might be a little more rigid in saying like, okay, everyone needs to know that I'm referring to males and females here. And so maybe certain contexts that would break down. But usually it's just like a social, you know, out of social politeness in certain contexts, it's totally appropriate to use someone's preferred pronouns. If people ask me my pronouns, I won't participate in like that pronoun sharing type of thing, but I will respect people's pronouns within reason.
Okay, I'm happy to hear that because I think that's respect that people deserve. So as far as common ground, ladies and gentlemen, we've established that gender dysphoria does exist, that adults should be able to do whatever they want with their bodies once they've reached adulthood, and that we would use somebody's preferred pronouns. Now, if you disagree, put that in the comments down below. And if you think there's any other points of common ground that maybe we missed, drop that down below. Now, let's get into, I think, the bulk and the heart of this debate is, do we think that sex and gender is different? Obviously, I think that sex and gender are two completely different things. I think it's actually quite unfortunate that when we're born, doctors just look at your anatomy and they tell mom and dad, oh, this is a boy or a girl. And we should really allow children to develop, find who they are, and realize that sex and gender are two different things. And ask the child, what do you believe your gender to be? Is there a point where you disagree with that? And what's wrong with that statement?
Yeah, there are some disagreements that I have with that. So it really depends what people mean when they talk about what gender is. I usually don't have my own definition. I usually I ask people what they mean by it so I know whether or not there's some confusion going on between their idea of gender and what biological sex is, and to make sure these things aren't being conflated. And a lot of people have their own sort of working definition of gender. Some people think gender is just equivalent to sex. I think a lot of conservatives would probably just use them interchangeably, like on a form it says gender, and they would probably check off male. But then there's these other notions of gender that these are the just average, you know, evolved behavioral differences between males and females, whether it's the result of, you know, some degree innate, some degree social There's a sort of a feminist definition of gender that looks that describes them as the sort of social roles and expectations that are placed on individuals based on the sex they're perceived to be. And then we have a lot of sort of the more gender activist types who think it's just like an identity where they're identifying with stereotypes of masculinity or femininity. So it really just depends on what you mean by gender. I think some of these definitions have utility. I think some of them kind of go in the route of pseudoscience. And I think, you know, some is just a matter of taste. So in some cases, I think, yeah, gender is separate from sex. I really just care about making sure we understand what sex is and how it has nothing to do with how you identify in your mind or anything like that. And just make sure that wall is nice and constructed and firm, and there's not any sort of leaks in that wall between sex
right.
and whatever other people tend to be talking
sure.
about.
Yeah, I think they're completely two separate things. I think sex just has more to do with this body that you're born in, and gender has more to do with your brain and your emotions and your feeling around who you think that you are inside. And I think that we should start to honor that. I mean, there's even been doctors, one out of Cleveland Clinic, his name is Dr. Altenay, and he says, quote, the body and the brain go in different directions, and gender is not only genitalia, that there's something in our brain that determines gender. And in the studies that he's looked over and MRIs and images of the brain, he says that brains perform differently in people that are transgender, and transgender brains tend to look more like the gender that they identify with in their MRIs. So I guess my confusion around that is, if we have proof that gender and sex are different, why are we trying to make these two things synonymous, and why can't we honor people who feel differently about their bodies?
So there is a way that things could get muddled up. You know, I don't think it is mm-hmm. useful to refer to, say, your gender identity as man or woman and have male and female be the sex terms, because this causes a lot of people to have confusion about what their types of behaviors and preferences and personalities mean about their biological sex. Ultimately, I think if we take a step back, we can realize that there's males, there's females. Within females, there's a huge range in distribution of their types of behavior. They can be very masculine. They can be pretty feminine. They can be more masculine than the average male. They can be more masculine than most males too. And even within males, you have this you know, bell curve distribution of how masculine and feminine they are. And most importantly, these two things overlap quite a bit. So just because you're like a hyper masculine female, this doesn't mean you're like mismatched in any way. This is a perfectly normal state to be in as a female. It might not be the average, you might be closer to the male average on certain traits. That doesn't mean that these traits are inherently essentially male or female. It's just sort of the distribution of traits we have among males and females. To then switch and to talk about like, oh, these are mismatched, like your mind is mismatched with your body. You know, this entails a high degree of biological essentialism. It's actually sort of a metaphysical claim that there can be something like wrong about your body and how bodies come to form. You know, people aren't born into bodies. Your brain and your body develop, you know, in concert together. And then regarding the studies that you mentioned about the brains being different, so there's actually a major confound in these studies, because we do find that the brains of people who are homosexual, like a homosexual man, tend to be more feminized. They tend to look sort of more on the female end of the spectrum, and vice versa. So people who are lesbians tend to be more gender nonconforming. Their actually brains tend to be more masculinized. You know, this is an influence of their sexuality. It's not like determining of it. When you actually control for sexual orientation in all these studies with that they've looked at for people with gender dysphoria, you actually don't find any relationship whatsoever between how feminized or masculinized someone's brain is and what the sex that they identify as. So this really has more to do with whether or not someone is gay or straight than whether they have gender dysphoria. What you do find is the differences is those who have gender dysphoria have differences in their brain, this sort of default mode network that has to do with how people appear to themselves, you know, their self-perception of their body. This is the same area of the brain that people who have something like anorexia, who they look in the mirror and they think that they look fat even though they're withering away. We see this in people who have body integrity disorder, you know, people who think that they would much rather not have a certain limb. You know, they want to modify their body in other ways. This runs also is correlated with being on the autism spectrum disorder. So if we're going to go with like this wrong body thing, if your brain looks like the other, you know, the other sex, I mean, you would basically have to be committed to say that homosexuals are actually born in the wrong body or they're mismatched rather than gender dysphoric people. Because right now there's no evidence that suggests that people with gender dysphoria have brains that look like the opposite sex. And even if they did, that still wouldn't get you to a place saying that like there's something wrong with you or something out of alignment. You know, that's sort of a claim that science can't make. We can describe the way things are, but we can't say, ooh, this is out of alignment here. We need to fix you. The only thing that needs to be fixed, really fixed, is if people express discomfort, then that's a treatment that, you know, they might need to be treated for that. But ultimately, you have to ask somebody how you feel. And then that's what we should be basing our treatment off of.
Okay, fair enough. I'll be honest, I did not know about looking into the controls on those studies and accounting for that as well, and that there might be a difference there that negates what people are saying. Now, Colin, I went on Twitter and looked through some of your tweets, and I did find a little bit of transphobia there, so I do want to come and look through them.
Only a little.
And have you sort of account for some of the things that you're saying and see if you can give a different perspective. Now, one of the tweets that I saw is you saying that gender ideology is just trendy pseudoscience. No. Now, I see a lot of people on your end of the spectrum saying this is just a trend, that people are identifying with this because they're seeing it a lot maybe on social media, or they're already feeling a little bit of discomfort with their bodies and they find this community that is ready to welcome them. But don't you think that maybe more people are identifying as trans because we have more research on the subject matter now and we're now in a society that's more accepting of it? Because this tweet, gender ideology is just a trendy pseudoscience, to me sort of implies that gender is a choice, when really this is what these people are feeling in their brains, their hearts, their souls, and they just want to be seen and accounted for as the gender that they believe themselves to be.
You know, I think there could be some truth to, you know, a greater sign, greater societal acceptance. Some people might feel more comfortable admitting that they're trans or showing that they have dysphoria. But in large part, I think the answer is no. The dramatic increase in people who are identifying as trans, I think, has very little to do with greater societal acceptance. And I think it really has almost everything to do with this creeping definition of what it means to be trans that has sort of grown to encompass simple gender nonconformity or rejecting like the social norms and roles and expectations that society is exerting on people based on their perceived sex. So this is, I think, really evident in the rise of the non-binary identity, because this is seen as a subset of trans people. And important to note is the non-binary people, they're not claiming to be intersex, okay? Even though they will say things like they don't identify with being male or female, they're not saying they're intersex. The binary that they're referring to, that they're identifying out of, is the binary social roles and expectations that are placed on males and females by society. So a trans person, in their view, is someone who rejects the social roles and expectations placed that society places on them based on their sex. And therefore, you can either be a binary trans person, which is someone who identifies with the opposite roles and expectations based on their sex, or you can be a non-binary trans person who rejects both those social roles, so these roles of masculinity and femininity. Many LGBT organizations now aren't even secretive that this definition has changed anymore. There's a group called EGALE. It's in Canada. They provide all like the LGBT curriculum and stuff to the schools in Canada. Their definition of being trans is literally, if you don't act the way society expects you to behave based on what's between your legs, so your genitalia, then you're transgender. And they even claim that you don't need dysphoria. You don't even need to feel uncomfortable to be transgender. So this is just pure gender nonconformity. And so since the vast people, majority of people, you know, we're not perfect stereotypes. We're not all Barbies or G.I. Joes. We are really all non-binary in a very literal sense to some degree. You know, I have some stereotypically feminine aspects about me. Like I'm very nurturing. I would like nothing more than to like bottle feed kittens, for instance. That's something that I really like to do. And so I think it's this new expansive definition is why so many kids are identifying as trans. And the most troubling part is that the medical community hasn't really caught up with this. They're still treating people who claim to be trans as though they are from this the old definition that was much more rigid. There was much more gatekeeping over it, and there was much lower incidence of sort of desisting and false positives. So I really do think, you know, are there more people identifying as trans? Yes, but that's because someone like me and probably you would fall in that definition based on identification with these rigid stereotypes that it tends to now be referring to.
Okay, I gotcha. Now, I'm sure this is a question that you get asked a lot on all your platforms and maybe in some debates and interviews that you do on this, but I'm just wondering, why do you care? Why do people care about this? Why can't we just identify as whatever we want to be? And why do we have to be in sort of these rigid ideas of what it means to be male, of what it means to be female? Why can't we just allow people to lead their lives the way they want to?
Oh, I'm all about, you know, letting people live their lives the way they want to. I think this is kind of what feminism had previously been advocating for, was not this making gender roles more rigid, but they would try to say that they view gender roles as being oppressive, and they would say, you can be a man, you can be a woman, and by those they would define those as adult human males and females. You shouldn't feel bound by society. Society is going to pressure you to be maximally masculine if you're a man, or maximally feminine if you're a female. But the previous way we thought about these things was to reject that, saying if you're a masculine female, you need to be who you are. Don't try to be overly feminine and be who you aren't because of what society is expecting or telling you to be or what you should be. What we've done now with the whole rise of gender ideology isn't rejecting these social roles. It is really just sort of rigidifying it, making them more rigid. And it's saying something like, if you're a really masculine female, you know, if you what we might call, you know, just a masculine woman, this is actually evidence that you're not actually a woman. You really are a man, you know, trapped in a woman's body. Or if you're a hyper feminine male, they're saying that, well, if you're exhibiting these stereotypes of femininity, then by definition, you're a woman. So it's sort of just making these gender categories more rigid. Instead of saying that men and women can just express themselves any way they want to, you know, this is that. I think that's the more liberative way to think about this, rather than saying, you know, both males and females can be either men or women, and that's based purely on a stereotype of masculinity or femininity. That does not seem progressive. That seems, you know, we're sort of letting an old school sexist define what a male and female is, essentially, and I just think that needs to be rejected. Plus, it is being medicalized. So you have someone not only, you know, who would just be a tomboy normally, now they're identifying as trans, and then we have this whole medical apparatus that swings into play here, saying that, like, oh, you're trapped in the wrong body, potentially, you know, would you like puberty blockers? Would you like a double mastectomy for a girl who's, you know, claims to be a man trapped in a woman's body? All these things. So there's just, like, so many things that are coming into it. It's sexist, it's potentially damaging to people's bodies. It's confusing kids about the relationship between their mind and body, all across the board. I think it's just a big mess.
I actually think that I can agree with you on some of that. I think so much of the argument around transgenderism is about these sort of pre-made gender norms of boys like blue and girls like pink, and then suddenly a girl likes blue and they think that she's a boy. And I think we should stop focusing on those sort of characteristics of gender and focus more on the feeling in the heart and the feeling in the mind that these young kids are feeling. Because you mentioned that you're okay with people doing whatever they want with their bodies, but you don't seem to feel that way when it comes to children, because you tweeted out the pushback about gender ideology is not about, quote, fear and bafflement at the sexual mores of the young, end quote. It's about resisting a radical pseudoscientific ideology encouraging children to dissociate from their bodies. Now, I disagree with this because I think children know who they are. And when we look at studies of transsexual and transgender people, they state that many of them knew that they were a different gender as young as 7 to 8 years old. And they tried to express it or had trouble expressing it at such a young age. But now we have children that, because we're educating them on these different identities and the different ways that you can live in this world, who are starting to express that at those ages of 7 and 8 and some even younger than that. Why not honor those kids when we know that they can grow up to be transgender adults who make these decisions anyway?
Yeah. So I think that there is this narrative that kids know who they are from a very young age and that this is what they're going to be potentially forever. I just don't think that's true just on its face. I mean, I'm looking at myself when I was a kid. And, you know, I thought at certain times I was a Ninja Turtle. You know, there were times where I thought I wanted to get piercings in high school. And I'm really glad I didn't get those. I'm really glad I didn't get tattoos. You know, there's all types of things that we think that kids aren't able to really consent to because we know that how much people change throughout their life. Are we really going to let some kid who's 5 years old, 12 years old, 17 years old, make these life-altering decisions for themselves when they very well might not persist in this dysphoria, you know, into adulthood? Because this often includes things like sterilizing yourself. There's no takesy backsies when you do that. You know, if you have your testicles removed or if you have your, you know, a hysterectomy, like you're never going to have kids ever. I always thought I didn't want kids up until about 2 years ago, and I'm 36 years old. So I'm glad I didn't get a vasectomy or anything like that. That would have been a huge mistake for me. So ultimately, I think, yeah, we should let kids be who they are in terms of let a masculine girl be masculine and let an effeminate boy be effeminate. But this doesn't mean that they are, a masculine girl is actually a boy and an effeminate boy is actually a girl, and that they need to have hormones to reflect this apparent, you know, mismatch, because I don't think there is really they aren't mismatched. You know, I do see this tendency to want to give masculine girls testosterone and effeminate boys, you know, estrogen or stop their puberty. I do see this as a type of sort of a new form of gay conversion therapy. I mean this quite literally, because we do know that gender nonconforming kids, the masculine girls and the feminine boys, they overwhelmingly tend to grow up to be homosexual adults. You know, the previous type of conversion therapy, you know, with the conservative Christians, you know, where they try to zap kids or whatever, you know, this was designed to, you know, let's change their mind to reflect their body, because they perceived a mismatch between their sexual behaviors and their sex. You know, why is a boy liking other boys? There was a perceived mismatch there. And so now what we're doing is basically the exact opposite. Rather than trying to change their minds to match their bodies, I think a lot of what gender ideology is doing to kids is it's telling them that they can change their bodies now to match their minds. And ultimately, this is going to affect kids who would grow up to be gay. I do view it as a form of gay conversion therapy that is getting largely overlooked in society. So let kids behave how they want to. Don't feed them pseudoscience about being born in the wrong body. Let them grow. If they do grow up to maintain their dysphoria, then they can take steps to try to fix that you know, discomfort that they have. But I think in terms of kids, you need to let them grow and develop, you know, naturally.
Interesting. Yeah. So you talk about this sort of irreversible damage. I know it's a common thing that people use. They read Abigail Schreier's book, and suddenly that's the term that they throw out, these irreversible measures that people are taking with kids. And while I do agree with you to some extent, maybe we shouldn't cause sterilization and things like that with children, but what about things like puberty blockers that, you know, you can stop at any point and just go back on the same track that you were on with the gender you were born with? Or what about social transitioning, where we just allow kids to take on the pronouns that they want to have on any given day and wear whatever clothes they want and be treated like a girl without going through that medical transition process?
So regarding puberty blockers, there is this talking point you hear from people like Jack Turbin, these gender medical doctors, who will say something like that you just said, you know, puberty blockers are fully reversible. It's just like a pause button to have kids buy time so they can think about their gender. And then if they were to go off these, then they can just resume normal puberty if they want to. This is actually a claim that is not based on its application to gender dysphoric youth. Okay. This claim, I'll first say that the use of puberty blockers in kids with gender dysphoria is an off-label use. Okay. These drugs were not approved to treat gender dysphoria. What they were approved to treat and designed to treat was a condition called precocious puberty, which is a condition where, you know, a 5-year-old girl, for instance, might begin puberty at 5. Okay. this has a lot of consequences on their body. You know, their hormones spike. It messes up the way that their bones develop. It's bad across the board for them. So they're usually given, if they exhibit precocious puberty, they're given puberty blockers when they're five. This is designed to then, you know, make it so it stops their puberty. And then when they turn about 10 or 11, they're taken off puberty blockers so that they can go through puberty naturally when other girls at their age and their body is more able to handle the effects of their sex hormones and going through puberty. That's what it's designed for. And there are certain side effects, but, you know, it's by and large much better than having a five-year-old go through puberty and all the effects on the body that has. So they're reversible in the sense that, yeah, if you take a kid off puberty blockers who is on them since five and let them go through puberty naturally during the normal time window when they would be naturally going through it, it's fine. Their puberty progresses naturally. What we don't have data on is the off-label use, which is puberty blockers given to kids who are at the beginning of puberty to stop their puberty during the time window when they would normally be going through puberty, when their body is going through all sorts of other changes. That's what we don't have data on. What we do know, though, is that the kids who are not given puberty blockers, who exhibit sort of this gender dysphoria at a young age, about 85% of them tend to desist, meaning their gender dysphoria alleviates naturally and they tend to grow up to be just homosexual adults. Kids who are put on puberty blockers, almost 100% of them persist in their dysphoria and are then going on to cross-sex hormones and surgeries. Okay, they tend not to desist. So what the puberty blockers seem to be doing is solidifying their dysphoria, making it so, you know, their dysphoria doesn't alleviate and they go on to take cross-sex hormones. So this is, you know, potentially catching up a lot of kids who are false positives who would otherwise desist, but who are given this drug that basically keeps their dysphoria present, which then leads them to go on to take cross-sex hormones, make other lifelong body altering, changes. You also mentioned social transition.
Yes.
And,
yes.
You know, this is something that some schools are doing to their kids, kids away from without their parents knowing about these things. It is a type of therapy, and there is evidence that social transitioning is sort of a first step that can also sort of solidify this dysphoria in kids. If you're a boy and you say, I'm actually a girl, and everyone says, you're right, you are. You know, this makes you less likely to sort of consider alternative viewpoints and sort of grow into who you might be, and, you know, explore your identity naturally, free of like social pressure. So, this is something that can maybe be done for a subset of kids who were screened, who were very less likely to persist in their to desist in their dysphoria. But it's still a medical intervention that can solidify people's dysphoria.
Right. In all the reading that I've done about this, when I look up studies on transgender people, transgender youth, I'm finding a lot of studies that support social transitioning, puberty blockers, and medical transitioning to a certain extent as well. And it seems that it's far easier to find studies in support of this than studies that denounce this process. And when I hear a lot of conservatives talk about it, they bring up the work of Ken Zucker, and he's been ousted from the medical community. Nobody wants to hear from him because they know that his stuff is bunk. It's not true at all. And I'm wondering, you know, you mentioned on your Twitter that it's not okay to oust these scientists out of the medical community and say that they can no longer participate in this, but don't doctors have a Hippocratic oath and sort of scientists as well when they're doing these studies? They're not supposed to be doing harm to people. And I think by and large, we can find 100 studies that say that allowing transsexual and transgender people to transition is better for them and is going to make them happy and healthier. So aren't these doctors who are trying to say opposite and advocate for what I like to call conversion therapy at this point, aren't they actually committing harm to their patients? And shouldn't they be ousted from the community?
So I don't think they should be ousted. There is a big tendency for people who don't sort of toe the line on a lot of the newer therapies, you know, just affirming kids. They tend to be harangued. They tend to be told that they're transphobic. This has sort of led to this sort of spiral of silence where you don't have you know, people who have reasonable objections to what's going on, voicing their opinions. It's also important to note that a lot of the studies where they talk about, you know, these kids who receive puberty blockers or cross-sex hormones, they're, you know, they tend to be really happy and everything. So these studies are based on like a very different type of protocol. So there is a protocol called the Dutch protocol that used to be the universal protocol for diagnosing kids with gender dysphoria. So it focused on individuals who were, you know, would say they have to be insistent, consistent, and persistent, you know, claiming that, you know, they're not born as they don't feel like they were the sex that they were born as. These kids express, you know, hate at their genitals at very young ages, you know, like age three, the first time they begin speaking. Sometimes the first thing they're saying is expressing dislike of their own bodies. And they found that once puberty hit, though, you know, over 80% of these kids would desist. So the kids who did not desist at puberty, you know, as I mentioned, they tend to go on to just be homosexual adults. What we have now, though, isn't these kids who express dysphoria from a very young age who then continue to persist in their dysphoria once puberty hits. Okay, those kids are very likely to benefit from puberty blockers and things like that. You know, there's still a discussion of whether it's still ethical, you know, how many kids, you know, might it not be appropriate for who are getting caught up in it. But there's a very low desistance rates, at least in this cohort of kids who are properly diagnosed from a young age and they maintain dysphoria throughout their life through puberty, et cetera. We've sort of changed throughout that whole Dutch protocol now. What we do now is a thing called affirmation therapy, which is basically just accepting someone who's a kid who's claiming a cross-sex identity immediately. They come and they say, like, I feel like a girl, and they're a male. And we just say, you are what you say you are. You know, here's an affirmative consent form. You can get your cross-sex hormones. You can get your mastectomy, all those things. This is an entirely new type of presentation of being trans. You know, this is almost never seen before. These are kids who have no history of even gender nonconformity or saying that they feel like they're born in the wrong body until they're like 11 or 12 years old. And surprise, surprise, it tends to run in social circles as well. So there's evidence that there's like a social contagion aspect of this. And because we've told people that if you don't just accept everyone and their identities, that you're a bigot and you're out of the medical community, we can't tell these kids that they're not trans. We can't do any sort of exploration with, why do you feel this way? Why does they tend to be have such a high level of autism in these people who are claiming these things too? So all the data looking at, you know, the positive benefits is done in this older cohort that had much more gatekeeping, had much more rigorous protocols for ensuring that there weren't a high rate of false positives. We have no idea what the current rates of these false positives are. We just know that there's a lot of detransitioners out there who are saying that they felt like they were fast-tracked through a process and no one really told them what they were in for. The data is going to be coming out because these are being tracked now, but this is currently, we don't have any sort of long-term longitudinal studies, meaning you measure them at one point, you measure them after some point. We have that data with, again, the old cohort of kids, but not this new sort of rapid onset gender dysphoria group.
So what would you like to see happen surrounding these conversations with children? Are you in the boat of people who says these are conversations that we shouldn't be having in schools? Because I think regardless of whether or not we influence children in this direction, they're going to be seeing this stuff, whether they see it on the internet, whether they see it at their local grocery store where a trans person happens to be shopping, and they're going to have questions regarding this. I don't see why schools can't have these conversations surrounding gender, so long as they're not influencing or pushing children to do these things.
So I would agree, since you added that last bit, you know, but I don't trust the current teachers based on their political, you know, lean, really even know what's going on, knowing about the definition of what it means to be trans, how that has changed in recent years. I don't think they have a proper understanding of what biological sex is or what gender identity is and what kids are actually claiming when they say that they identify as the opposite sex. I think that what it usually boils down to in schools is kids getting these lessons, like using something like the genderbread person or the gender unicorn, which again is just teaching them that being a boy means you're masculine, being a girl means you're identifying with femininity, those types of things. I would rather them just not address these things in school. Yeah, their kids are going to get these things from social media. They're going to get them on TikTok. They're going to get them on Instagram. It's going to be hard for parents to really control what their kids are seeing, but at least parents, you know, if they are giving them phones at a young age, there's ways they can lock certain apps. It's not going to be easy. It's going to be a leaky bucket probably of the content kids are getting. They're going to see stuff they probably shouldn't have. But we don't need to therefore double down and say, okay, then it's okay to be in our public schools. You know, if you have a private school and you want to teach kids the genderbread person, knock yourself out. I think it's harmful, but, you know, that's what they can do if they choose to do it. Just as I think you can learn about Noah's Ark if you're, you know, going to a private religious school for your kids. Again, I wouldn't recommend it, but that's something that they can do. I think a lot of what we have now in public schools is teachers using these resources that's causing a lot of this confusion in kids. And I'd much rather them just not even go there because I just don't think they're equipped in any capacity to deal with the nuances of these topics.
Fair enough. Okay. I think I can start to see your point there and maybe agree with you a little bit on that. They should be educated people talking about these issues if they're going to have this in schools. And I do think a lot of the teachers who talk about this have no idea what it means and the differences between gender and sex and all of that fun stuff. In the interest of time, Colin, I think we're going to close out our debate for today. I'm wondering if there's any final thoughts that you want to share with people who might represent my aisle of thought on this particular issue. What would you want them to know, and if they're open-minded to your beliefs, what's something that you would want to say to them?
I just want to say that, you know, there's a lot of scare tactics going around with people like me who have different opinions from a lot of the, you know, the so-called trans rights activists. Most of the people who are making the arguments that I'm making, we're not anti-trans in any sense. A lot of us are actually, up until maybe recently, considered ourselves on the left. I mean, I've voted for Democrats my entire life. That might change in upcoming elections, but, you know, who knows? I just think we need to have these open conversations and not immediately think that just because I just disagree with people on certain issues and trans, that means we're evil. It's coming from a place of compassion. There's compassion all around. I don't think the people who are pushing the gender ideology are not compassionate. I think they are. I know many of the people previously that were my colleagues. I know they care very deeply. They think they're doing good, just as I think I am. I see where they're going wrong, and I would love to have these conversations. Unfortunately, I can almost never get a conversation with these people because they have sort of smeared my reputation before the conversation, and they don't want to platform a transphobe or something. I just would try to look at people as humans. We're all compassionate. We're coming from a place. We all want what's best for kids. Just hear us out. Hear us out this argument. You know, we can have civil disagreements about these things. And it's not just a, you know, black and white, good versus evil. So that's what I would recommend and hope that we can do moving forward.
Beautiful, beautiful, Colin. I'm going to take off these little devil horns now and assume my role as Amla Fanobi again with my own thoughts. And I agree with everything you just said for the last, I don't know, 45 minutes. That was fantastic. Guys, we are going to close out today's show, Devil's Advocate, with that beautiful message. I want you guys to comment down below. Is there something that you learned through the duration of watching this? Is there a subject matter or a talking point that you wish we had hit on and you wish we had discussed? Colin, I know people are going to watch this and immediately wonder where they can follow you, how they can support you, how they can read your articles. What can people do?
So I'm mostly on Twitter. It's my social media of choice, and you can follow me at Swipe Right, and that's Right, my last name, W-R-I-G-H-T. And then if you're interested in learning about the debates about sex and gender, why sex isn't a spectrum, debunking a lot of the arguments a lot of gender activists are making, you can go to my website. It's www.realitieslaststand.com. It's based on Substack, and either subscribe or, you know, become a free member and get weekly updates and on the news and get equipped with the best arguments to debunk a lot of the pseudosciences out there.
That's fantastic. I'm sure all of them are going to go and want to support you. I must say you gave me a run for my money. I had to like go. I was thinking about this all last night, like assuming my old role, writing down all the things that I would have said. And I just knew, just based on all the stuff that I've seen you write and following you, that you were just going to hit all these out of the park. And you did exactly that. You are fantastic.
Thank you so much.
Fantastic. Thank you guys so much for watching. Hopefully we'll have Colin on in the future. I'm sure there's going to be no shortage of talk around gender theory, transgenderism, especially with this whole debate around whether or not we should be introducing this to children. So write down below if you'd like to see Colin back. And I will take all of your suggestions. Thank you so much for watching. Bye, guys.